country currently, but all right. Welcome to this episode of She Drives Me Crazy, your only podcast for detailed breakdowns of the George Lopez Show, episode by episode. I am one of your hosts, Kyle, joined by my other Lopez lover, Tim. How are you doing today?
I'm doing quite well. It's a little warm here, but I'm managing. How are you?
Same. It's hot as fuck. And that's like every episode we talk about. I don't know, there's no breeze. Like, every room in my house is freezing, and then this little, like, office is so hot. And I think it's just all the comics, and I think it's the action figures. All those, like, plastics are, like, sucking up the cool air for me to live. But doing good. Trying to put off telling you we got some bad news again, Tim.
Did we do it again?
We did it again, and I hate doing it to you. I know you wanted to talk about the episode of George Lopez where Carmen gets her learner's permit and she wants to learn how to drive. She drives with Benny, and Benny gets caught drinking with Carmen driving, and Benny has to go to court. Benny then has to wear an embarrassing sign, and George drives with... I'm not reading all this. We can't talk about that episode of George Lopez today. We actually have a really good episode, Tim. We're going to talk to Crater for Mr. Butter Chips. I'm really excited to do this one. Just came out. We're going to be talking to... I should ask. I always forget. It's Alex Schumacher, correct?
Yep, that's correct. Okay,
I'm pretty sure it's like Joel Schumacher. Like, I don't want to guess and be like...
Yeah, that's both a blessing and a curse, because at least they know how to pronounce it, but it's also Joel Schumacher. So, you know, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe now that he has passed, you can... surpass, although there's like a couple Alex when I was doing some research. So I always try to, I'm like, there's a lot of Alex Schumachers, so gotta wade in there.
I've never ever Googled myself, but if I had a lot, I would have found that there's also a drummer that has a lot of videos online.
Yes, I assume.
But that's not because I Googled myself frequently at all.
Which is always, and it was always like, sometimes I'm like, well, I gotta make sure I get these names right whenever we do any of these. So, like, I'll Google them, and, like, sometimes I can't find, like, a video or, like, luckily you did podcasts where I listened, and I was like, all right, I think the host, he didn't correct the host, so it's probably right.
Yeah.
Sometimes people are just nice. But I found some sometimes where, like, I don't find the person, but I find someone with the same name, and they say it. I'm like, all right, well, I hope that's close, and hopefully it's just not a colloquialism. It's wrong. But.
No, you got it.
So we're going to be, and obviously a wide, vast array kind of work you've done, but we're going to be talking, I think, a lot about Mr. Butter Chips. Came out, what did you say, August, what is it? I know it just came out, 14th?
Yeah, well, it was out early July, actually.
Okay.
But still pretty recently.
And this is, I think, something me and Tim try and do a lot is kind of cover the breadth of comics and what that is and that approach to it and the kind of wide range people have to the medium. And obviously this is something different. I think we see a lot of this more now, which it makes more sense. But I mean, how did you come to kind of these I think more classical, like, comic type strip things that then progress into these longer form things together? I know you did that with a lot of the other stuff, even like you're on like what 200 of the current running.
Oh, decades of inexperience. Yeah, we're at 225 or something at this point.
Jeez.
Yeah.
So how did that come to you, kind of for this approach to the comics, kind of like the more, I guess, per se classical sense, but like I think you're working in a lot of the actual like comic narrative portions as well, kind of building larger things.
Right. Yeah. My grandparents gave me the Smithsonian collection of newspaper comics when I was a kid, and it is this monstrosity of a coffee table book and just covers kind of the entirety of the history of comic strips. So, like you said, you know, classical comics. And my initial objective when I was, you know, trying to build a career as a cartoonist was to be a syndicated comic strip artist. So I think the laying of the groundwork and the foundation of what I'm doing now started there. So I'm sure a lot of that sort of seeped over or seeped into what I'm doing currently.
and it's such a, I love, like, a lot of the old stuff, even like Dr. Seuss's work, or they recently put out, I don't know if it was recently, they did like a huge collection of like the New Yorker cartoons. And again, there's such a, and I think it's so important in regular comics, and I think it's kind of like underappreciated, or I don't think it's noticed in the transition, especially with kind of these classical satirical political cartoons, and kind of what you're doing with Butter Chips and other work, is like you have to be very clear, you have to be very distinct in your visual storytelling because of kind of their narrative you're saying. So it's like a lot of times I think it is a artistically more pressure in the sense of being able to pull things off, obviously in a shorter time frame, but also visually, like it has to generally be a lot clearer and easier to read because there's like such a short time frame to build kind of the point of that strip.
Yeah, there's definitely an economy of words and art that need to be implemented when you're doing something like that. And with Butter Chips specifically, that's a monthly comic. So, with, you know, regardless of the collection, it came out monthly. So that's, the book is from April of 2016 through April of 2020. And so especially with that, when I'm kind of covering current issues and more topical subjects, I do have to be pretty judicious with what I'm talking about and how I'm choosing to discuss it.
And I mean, that seems like a pretty uneventful time frame to cover. I'm not sure why you picked... That doesn't seem like a whole lot going on in the past couple years.
No, I mean, it's dried up very quickly, and I'm kind of scrambling for things to rail against every month, but, you know, I end up finding something to bitch about, and it, you know, goes okay.
How did kind of then Butter Chips come about? Because, like I said, I know, like, you're kind of... other work, and you do it in Butter Chips as well, kind of a lot of more like personal, introspective, like slice of life type stuff. But obviously Mr. Butter Chips is more kind of again, obviously coming out in a fairly important time in I think a lot of people's lives currently, and kind of that change that was happening. Well, I mean, how did you come to that with Mr. Butter Chips? And it was being published, it was Drunk Monkeys?
Yeah, it's still on the Drunk Monkeys site monthly. So the genesis of Mr. Butter Chips, it's a little bit more extensive in the book. I go over it, but basically he is a holdover from a comic strip that I was trying to get syndicated. So back when I was initially trying to get in the funny papers... or in the funnies, he was part of an ensemble cast. And that comic was just not good, you know, to be quite honest, to be frank. And that cast of characters sort of fell away, and Mr. Butter Chips remained because it always felt like a compelling character for me. And anytime you have a character, especially an anthropomorphic animal, called Mr. Something, that's going to be inherently funny. So I feel like right off the bat, I'm telling you not to take what I'm saying too seriously, you know? Like, listen, and if you get something out, listen, and if you get something out of it, fantastic, but, you know, screaming into the void. So it sort of evolved from that initial comic strip ensemble cast. And so when I pitched it to Drunk Monkeys, it was... essentially just an homage to all of the underground comics of the 60s and 70s. So it was more, you know, fueled by drugs, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll kind of aesthetic. And then that was about 4 or 5 months before the 2016 election. So the election came about, and Mr. Butter Chips kind of transformed into my id, or my lizard brain, just... and I'm putting that down on the page. So there is some introspection, but it's also a little bit less mitigated than what I would do in another comic.
Right. And I love, I mean, the collection is so great because I mean, obviously kind of everything there, but also like to see that kind of descendants into like what was going on at the time. Like you said, the very first like couple strips, pages are like you said, those, they're very like gritty, like kind of underground comics and like mm-hmm. dealing with those and that type of humor. And then it like, you can see like kind of slowly the slide into you like delving into what's going on socially, politically, stuff like that, and then kind of where the series ends up is such a like really great kind of like view into not only like, again, what's going on with you, but also kind of like society and our structure as a whole, as to like this timeline, this like now documented like descent for you in this. It's such a really kind of interesting thing to see. And I mean, it wouldn't be interesting if it wasn't good, and that's where it also comes about. Like, is very good.
No, thank you. Yeah, it sort of chronicles, I think, my own mindset and a lot of people's mindset just to the depravity and insanity that we've witnessed over the last, you know, 3.5 years, the way this country has just devolved. And, you know, so when people call Mr. Butterchips a political strip, which I have done too, for, you know, it sort of works as a marketing term, but I push back on that a little, because the way that I consider it, it's more satirical and mm-hmm. it, you know, it's supposed to be humorous, but it's also not, it's talking about issues that have been politicized as opposed to trying to proselytize one side's views or the other. You know, it's saying hatred is wrong, you know, racism is wrong, you know, gun violence is wrong. And to me, those shouldn't be political issues. That's, I think, one of the more just outrageous things that I've come to find in delving more into politics, because I was never really all that political before now, and I hate to say that, but it's true. I did not keep up with current events with the same voracious appetite that I do now, because it almost feels like things are unraveling, you know, minute by minute.
Yeah, I think seeing that a lot. I mean, going to college and being like a history political science major, like I was like just involved in that world, like that was something that always interests me. My wife never like couldn't care less. No, I wouldn't say couldn't care less, but like, you know, like it wasn't a part of her life. And then like, you know, when 2016 happened, like that's all she, like, you know, she's listening to NPR every day, she's watching the news, she's doing all this, she's reading everything she can. And like, so I'm like having those conversations with her, but then I'll start talking about like, well, you know, like when this with Clinton, and these are kind of issues that were like built in, and she'll be like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, it's always been, but it's, I think that's where you, like you're saying, coming, like anyone who kind of reads this and approaches Mr. Butterchips, it's interesting because it, like you said, it's a political cartoon, but it, not so much, because like to say like our lives aren't always just political, like it's just part of being a human being, is like you could be not interested in politics, but for some reason, you know, healthcare affects you, and like that comes Absolutely. Across in your life. And I think that's what's really interesting with Mr. Butterchips, is like, again, he's not engaging in, it's not like the typical, I can't think of that really terrible political cartoonist who writes everything out. He like, he has to like, fuck, I wish I could remember his name. He's a conservative. Like, he like writes everything on the image to explain what it is.
Oh, Ben Garrison? Are you talking about that piece of shit?
Yeah, that guy.
As soon as you said he has to label all his drawings, I knew who you were talking about, because the artwork is so poor. It's akin to a second grader. You know, they have to tell you that they're drawing a dog. Right. And this guy who is a you know, professed professional has to do the same thing. That's pretty abysmal.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you should not have to label your... The whole point of it being a cartoon is that, again, like I said, what I think you do well is, like, you have to be very clean, and you have to be very descriptive and understand what you can get across, like, quickly and, like, precisely. And then, like, where that is a, like, he's just, like, proselytizing, like, political ideas, whereas yours is, like Mr. Butterchips is this anthropomorphic... I always struggle with this word.
Anthropomorphic.
lives in this world, and that those issues happen to affect him, and he is dealing with them within it. So it's like a, yeah. again a really interesting take versus like again this like jokey satirical thing where it comes the jokes and the satire come from like living the life of someone affected and being hurled into politics versus kind of the like direct approach to it.
Yeah, and I think, and I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about Ben Garrison because he's so garish and horrific, but you know, if you take that and contrast that with Mr. Butterchips, I would call his political because he's essentially just filleting Trump with every single one of his cartoons. Whereas, you know, I'm not on my knees to any one party or the other, and obviously my ideals align with a specific side, but I think there is kind of a compartmentalization for me where I'm really just talking about those things from like an ethical standpoint or a moral standpoint as opposed to a political one. That's what I try to do anyway.
Yeah, no, I think. does it help to have Mr. Butterchips be a monkey and kind of... Does that help as a vehicle to express and come upon like multiple situations for him? Like, do you think this would, like, what you were trying to do would work differently if it was like a character or like yourself in it versus kind of what you're able to do with Mr. Butterchips? Because almost like a lot of times he's able to be like a third party or being like pulled out of something and being able to comment on it because like he's a monkey sometimes. Like, it's, I think that plays well kind of what you're doing and it is able to be like a very good narrative device.
I think it absolutely is a good vessel for the sort of statements that I'm making with the comic because, you know, like you were talking about, I know I couldn't pull that off in the same way with something like Decades of Inexperience, or if I was doing something that was more memoir, you would have to, you know, finesse it a little bit more, I think, whereas with Mr. Butterchips, I just sort of wind him up and let him go. And it's cathartic for me, for certain. You know, I don't have to sort of watch my words or be careful about what I'm saying as to not piss off anybody. Because with Mr. Butterchips, I really don't care. And as said in the beginning, it's a cartoon monkey, so it's meant to be taken humorously. And I have received a few, you know, pieces of hate mail for it, which is really just laughable. Because how are you mad at this chain-smoking, alcoholic organ grinder monkey just because he may be saying something that you do or do not agree with? But for me, yeah, it's kind of fun just to let the monkey rant.
This being, again, I think another interesting thing about this collection is, and I think a lot too, I've had a lot of fun going back with Decades of Inexperience. Like,
oh, cool.
You're able to see kind of your progression, because all of your work tends to be like in this style, but there's like spectrums of the style, and I think right. Mr. Butterchips is, you know, again, kind of in the more, or at least with him, more cartoony, and you're able to like express and emote more, especially when you introduce, I think, the additional comic, the like 22 page one that's included. Like, I think that one's like a really great like expressive, exaggerated, cartoonish adventure. Are you able to see like then kind of you for your like evolution of style and how it changed over the course of it? And is it something doing this like kind of monthly and then again with like even Decades of Inexperience where you're really working on it like consistently, progressively? Does that help you as an artist to kind of like refine what you're doing with the series and kind of your whole approach to style?
It's funny that you bring that up because I was thinking about this the other day. Decades of Inexperience started in 2015 and Mr. Butterchip started in 2016. And I had been doing some work before that, but the one thing that I really realized that was kind of a revelation is that before 2015, I just wasn't working enough. I wasn't producing enough to evolve as an artist, to evolve as a writer. I would create some sort of submission, like I said, for either a comic strip syndicate or maybe a comic book publisher, send that out into the world, receive universal rejection, and then go into some depressed state for 6 months and not do anything. So with an ongoing comic, like Decades in Experience or Mr. Butterchips, and in between that, working on, you know, graphic novel pitches and other comics projects, it has become very evident to me that I was just not doing enough to progress before. And that's something with art that I've always thought about. You know, if I'm not progressing and my style isn't evolving and improving, more importantly, then there's really no point in doing it, because the whole point of art is it kind of, you know, changes with you. It flows with your mindset as you change. So the idea of remaining stagnant, which I kind of did before 2015, is sort of appalling at this point. But for the past, I guess, Jeff, like 5 years, 5.5 years, just that constant grind, I feel like has definitely, if not made me a better artist, made me a more professional one. And if that makes sense, just right. Being able to, you know, produce with at the capacity that I'm supposed to be producing, and, you know, with the self-imposed sort of limits or parameters to that.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think early on, like, I mean, and again, it kind of reflects kind of what you're going for and originally, like the very like heavy hatching and and line work, and then as it progresses and becomes like really this like more like experimental like expressionism of Mr. Butterchips, like it pulls back and you're like a lot of like thicker clean lines, and then like even then I love like the strips where like there's the maze one, and then there's the like what to get what to get the Patriot who has everything, and you're like that ability to kind of like adapt into different styles and like blend that in the strips is like really like interesting and like cool to see as it progresses.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to your point, my comics typically start out, and I don't know if I'm unique in this or not, I'm sure I'm not, but every artist wants to be unique, but, you know, just like everybody else kind of thing. So I think the comics are refined, the styles are refined as the comics progress, and especially with an ongoing one. I've always failed to do things like model sheets and really nail down the style that I want to use before starting a comic. I tend to just jump in with both feet, which is not advisable for anybody who's listening thinking about getting into comics. But so they become more refined as far as the vision for that comic goes. So there's definitely been that aspect to both Decades in Experience and Mr. Butterchips. So when you get to something like the standalone story in the book, it's very much the current iteration of that style and the character, and sort of hopefully seamlessly blends the social commentary and underground comic pastiches.
Does it... And we talked to like a little bit about kind of again like the nature of some like doing a project like this where again like these full page strips for you, is that especially because you're attempting almost every one attempting a level of humor and joke and satire to it, and like we talked about kind of be able to pull that something that's already very difficult to like pull off in comics or just in general, but to do it in that kind of like shortened time frame. I mean, is it generally like you taking an idea first and then how you want to approach it, or is it like I don't want to say joke because I don't necessarily like that conveys what it is, but taking the humor of the topic and then building it out, or I mean, I imagine it's a mixture of both, but like, how do you approach like these one strip things when it's like, again, it's like really hard to do all that. And again, you do it extremely well, which is great.
Well, I appreciate that. I think with Mr. Butterchip specifically, that ordinarily will start with a specific topic that I want to sort of lambast or discuss a little bit in that month's installment. So it'll start there, and then I sort of weave, I don't want to call it a joke, because that's, I think,
yeah,
dismissive of what actually it is. But there is a gag or a punchline in the last panel, for sure. So I sort of build it around whatever I want to talk about. And that part is probably the most difficult, because as we've said before, there's just so many things, you know, inundating us every single day that affects our lives. So the largest struggle with butter chips is to whittle it down to that one thing that I want to talk about for the entire month. Because I don't, you know, I won't have another chance to talk about anything for another month with that. So with something like Decades of Inexperience, it's a little bit more of an ongoing narrative. So it's episodic in that it's in weekly installments, and they don't necessarily, you know, follow sequentially. But with that, I can map out a little bit of a longer story. And I've started doing that a little bit more this year, where I'll do several different parts to one specific idea. So there's definitely different approaches to them. And I think it's a little more difficult with butter chips because of the time constraints and the amount of things at my disposal to actually talk about.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things too is reading this, again, and you're covering essentially like a 2 year ish, a little more period. And now we're in, like, you know, 2020, which is, you would think in the scope of time and everything that's going on, so different, but it's generally just repeated.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many of these that are still fairly relevant, but for different reasons. I mean, is that something like looking, or maybe the approach to the humor and the ideas to it is, I don't want to say be broad enough, but be something that when someone reads it either later or even goes back, I think even later, like, I mean, like I said, you can go back to like the Dr. Seuss stuff he was doing in the war. And while like it doesn't apply to me, like it's such a broad approach to a social topic that you can still read the humor and the thought behind it. Is that something too, being able to not be so specific, but being able to be like a broad social idea that is relevant to kind of anyone, even like looking back? I mean, it's like the vaccine one, which again, you know, that shit's still relevant, but also like the shit you were talking about is like super fucking relevant to the like terrible ideas people have of COVID currently.
Yeah. And, you know, it just seems like stupidity goes in cycles, and those cycles are just getting shorter and shorter now. So I don't know that I give it any kind of forethought when I'm writing it as to whether or not it will still be applicable, because most of the things that I talk about are almost always applicable. And there are specific incidents that happen at the time that I was writing it that sort of spurred me to write it. But most of the things that I'm talking about, again, like racism and intolerance in all of its forms and the pro-life, pro-choice argument, these are issues and debates and now, you know, comment section arguments that I don't think are ever going to go away. So I don't know if it's a conscious attempt to, you know, have the comic remain relevant, as it is to just allowing myself to, I guess, process and filter all of those things through this monkey.
Have you thought about actually creating those reaction figures as a way to take money from alt-right people?
I haven't, actually, but that's not a bad idea. You know, and that's sort of the joke, is you can see somebody seeing that and thinking, oh, I would totally buy one of those. And that's sort of the absurdity of it, is yes, it's outlandish, but at the same time, you know, there are definitely dollops of reality in there, and quite frightening and terrifying reality at that.
When he was, selling like plastic straws at one point. Was that what he was selling on his website? I think Trump, when they were like banning plastic straws. Yeah, I think you could buy like Trump straws on the website. I two questions I kind of have. I think maybe they overlap. I think maybe one also, like, one thing we've seen, I think, in kind of current culture, and there's, you know, a documentary, I think it's out or it's coming out, it's kind of the a movement or group taking over, you know, someone's media. So like Pepe the Frog, where was essentially this like this alternative, like almost kind of like underground type thing.
Yeah, Matt Furry's like, Boys Club, yeah. I believe it was. Yeah.
It's been like cultivated by this, like, you know, right wing, alt right, neo Nazis. And
yeah,
I mean, as a something again, kind of you putting this, maybe not so much like, I don't know if, like, obviously, when I don't know if you would worry about that, like creating Mr. Butter Chips, but like, as someone putting stuff online, and again, something where you're tackling like social issues, is like, I don't know if there's a question there. I was just, as I was reading this, I was thinking of that, like, specifically, because, like, again, that's something where, like, Mr. Butterchips is, he's obviously, like, a character that is, like, I think very approachable in that sense. And, again, like, I could see people reading this and not picking up the satire you are, like,
right,
putting out sometimes, and, like, aligning with it and adopting, like, oh, yeah, like, fuck this shit, like... It has to be interesting, again, like, kind of in that world, and then, again, opening yourself up to kind of all the criticism that comes with, like, commenting on something. I mean, we see that with, like Marvel, who kind of argues that they aren't political, but, like, may just have, like, a character kiss, or I don't even know, say, like, one thing, and, like, the shit that comes with it when you are actively, like, kind of making commentary on some issues. Is that something you think about when you're making it, or I don't know. Like, again, I don't really have a question, but, like, as I was reading, I was like, that has to be, like, I don't know, not just stressing. I would be very, I'm just a very non-confrontational person, so I'd be, yeah, like, so stressed when making it, like.
No, and I think people have that sort of reaction when they meet me in person, because I try to be fairly affable and likable, and treat people with respect and civility, because that's what, you know, humans deserve. So when I kind of made the impulsive, and it was impulsive, decision to have Butterchips start, you know, including social commentary, I don't think I really thought about any backlash at that point. It was just something I was really compelled to do, and maybe I should have thought about that. But I also haven't received all that much as far as negative feedback. Like I said, there were a few people who have written me to chastise me a little bit for, you know, there was one where there was sort of a Twitter warrior, or whatever I called them, because they would, you know, they tweeted something in outrage and then went to their dinner reservation. And so somebody who clearly had done that wrote to me and said, how dare you, you know, people posting things on Twitter are trying to make a difference too. And of course they are, you know, and that's the thing, is I'm not telling people to refrain from making their point of views known or support causes in any way they can. It's just a little bit of hypocrisy, which gives me a chuckle, and that I have to, you know, hold under the microscope a little bit, because it's not just the right wing that are full of, you know, hypocrisies and pretty harmful ideas. I mean, the left is too, to some degree. So it's not just about, you know, vilifying one side or the other for me. And again, I don't know that I thought about it enough. I probably didn't think it through to the extent that I should have before starting. But so far, you know, knock on wood, it's been fairly well received, because I think it's mostly been read by people who either, A, their views align with mine, or B, they understand that that's just a fucking joke.
Right. And I think you tackled that idea, or at least a similar idea, very thoughtfully in the Robotoad section.
Oh, sure.
Which I really enjoyed it. Was that something, like, see, then that would be, like, one where I would feel like, and I mean, even, again, that's so weird that, like, you know, kind of removed from when that came out, like, that is still a very relevant issue, especially, obviously, within comics, kind of.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Comicsgate thing is still going strong, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, I think I even did a hashtag, which I rarely use, but I did it intentionally to kind of draw out the Comicsgate people. I didn't receive any replies. So then I almost get upset, right? Like, I put this out in the world and it should make you really angry. Why are you not attacking me? And then the flip side of that is, well, you know, thank God nobody did, because that could have gotten really ugly.
Yeah.
But I'm not shy about expressing those opinions at this point, because again, if it's hatred or it's intolerance, regardless of the person or the party affiliation or whatever, it's wrong.
Yeah. And one thing too, again, I like the your stripped down version of a Robotoad who is similar to another character. Shows how blatant that is. It shows that it's just like a blatant Battletoad. Like that he's just true a fucking Battletoad.
And the idea was to be as generic as possible, because that's sort of a statement about the actual character that I'm lampooning.
Yeah. In this collection, you include, again, that extended story, which, like, I believe is 22 pages.
Yeah,
it is. And that's the first, I think, and only place it's collected.
The hope was that people would buy it for that story, so I'm still hoping, that's an exclusive that will drive at least some sales, maybe, or maybe people will say, no, your shit's fine for free, but I'm not going to pay for it.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the, again, kind of the collection of it prior and kind of, like, seeing how that has evolved, and, like, I think going into that is a psychotropic San Francisco sojourn.
Yeah.
Like, it is a culmination of kind of everything you were working on, and, like, again, like, the it's a really interesting, like, kind of epilogue for it, where, like, I think you're tackling everything you kind of wanted to do in the comic, it appears, and, like, really experimenting and having fun with it. You've done other ways. Is there a difference then, kind of, like, the longer form? Is that something you enjoy doing with him in that? Like,
yeah, it was a lot of fun. I hope I get to do more. And like you said, it is sort of this convergence of everything that's come before wrapped in this pretty package of an acid trip through San Francisco. So it was a lot of fun to write for that alone. And, you know, there's some pop culture references in there that, you know, some maybe fly under the radar, but they still make sense if you're reading it. You don't necessarily have to be in on the joke. And I think that's a problem that beginners make a lot, is where they'll include inside jokes, and that sort of excludes your audience. So I'll do that from time to time, as long as it still makes sense from a reader standpoint. But it was a lot of fun to put him in a longer format, and I would definitely do it again if SLG wants to keep publishing them or anybody else.
I think you tackle issues in it, but it is, again, a lot of, enjoyed, like, your ability to alter to a longer form narrative and make that work, especially pacing wise. If you were to ever, like, kind of focus on a more, like, longer narrative, something, like, is that something you would, focus more on, like, kind of the narrative, like, adventure type situation, versus, like, would it be more difficult to tell kind of the stuff you were doing in the strips in that longer form, do you think?
Are you talking about Buttership specifically?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think it's difficult, because it worked out pretty well. I think that 22 page standalone story was actually a trial run in some respects to see if I could do it and if it still works. And I think it did. So it wasn't necessarily difficult, but it required a different approach for sure. But I've also written several graphic novels and, again, decades of inexperience is kind of a long-form narrative. So the extended or protracted format was not necessarily new to me. It was just new to put butter chips in that specific format. But I think it worked out fairly well. I'm pretty pleased with it and think it's a lot of fun, if nothing else.
Yeah, I think it's pretty good. It's pretty good. Are you working? That's something I meant to ask her. Was butter chips? And I would have to imagine decades. Are you working digitally for this, especially like with the time frames you're working in?
Surprisingly, no.
No,
it's all traditional. I'm, you know, pen and paper, and then scan it in, and I add gray tones, which I started doing far more frequently, like a year or two ago. So that's all added in Photoshop. And it adds some depth to the page, I have found. So that's kind of why I've pulled back on some of the cross-hatching and stuff, too, is because I can add the gray tones and still have some volume, you know, and some girth to the page without killing my hand.
Right.
But yeah, I still work traditionally, and I'm possibly going to look into going digital going forward. I mean, it saves space and it's better for the environment and all of those kind of things that you have to factor in.
Yeah, but then it's an interesting thing. And again, like the feel of it, like it's so, especially again, the cartoon aspect to it is so classical. Like you just think of that, you know, ink paper. But I do like when you got into the longer form at the end. You said there was a lot more coloring in the gray tone, which made it feel like a little more like comic-y, and it's like, you know, like a single form comic in its approach with kind of more depth to it. Like I think you said.
Yeah, and it's something that's meant to be consumed in, you know, one sitting, as opposed to the individual strips that are, you know, month to month to month, and you sort of have to wait for the next one. So the longer form one was more of a meal in terms of just visuals and the writing as well, because I was packing a lot into those 22 pages. But yeah, I think that was definitely something that I thought about before actually putting that in the comic, you know, wondering whether or not it was going to work. But as you said, I think it does, you know, work rather well as sort of an epilogue to the story. And not that Mr. Butterchips is done, but for that specific book, I think it works as a good coda, as it were.
Someone, I mean, like you talked about being kind of, you know, just in the trenches with indie and self-publishing and kind of putting everything. How did it come about this time with SLG, and what has that been like having kind of that publishing aspect to it? You know, like, I mean, something we'll mention even at the end, but like, you know, Mr. Butterchips is available like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all that stuff, kind of that aspect to it, like having that kind of additional you know, availability to people as well.
It certainly makes me seem more respectable, right? I don't know if it actually does, but SLG Publishing, their history in indie and alternative comics is, you know, the thing of legend at this point. And I've always loved what they did. When I got back into creating comics in my early 20s, their catalog was one of the first that I discovered, and they were doing things like Milk and Cheese by Evan Dorkin and, you know, Johnny the Homicidal Maniac by Yonan Vasquez. So it was this world that I fell into because I felt a familiarity with it, as opposed to reading things by Todd McFarlane and Jim Lee and those people when I was growing up and looking at their artwork and knowing that I was never going to be able to reach that sort of echelon with my own line work. It was nice to find books that were more of an open or cartoony or even individualized style that made me think, this is something I can do. So getting published with them, even though they haven't been quite as active in the last, you know, 5 years or so, they're still a name to contend with. And it was sort of a full circle moment for me. I got to know Dan, who's the president of SLG and the publisher, through the Alternative Press Expo, which is no longer, but it was an indie comic show that he put on in San Francisco and San Jose for a long time. So the last one that was held, I actually ended up somehow getting involved in and helping him with some of the programming and planning. So we just kept in touch, and when I was looking to put out the Book of Butter Chips, he was the first person that I thought to reach out to, and luckily he was game. So it's really cool to have that SLG logo on my book, and I know that sounds like such an inconsequential, you know, factor, but for me it was huge.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess I think too, again, that the idea of kind of the legacy of SLG, and I think, and yeah, like anyone who's listening, and I can remember even like being, you know, a young kid like that, or when I started like revisiting comics like in high school, again, like discovering that there was more than like Marvel and DC is like such an experience for people.
Sure.
I think, and then like just that I think appreciation that a lot of people have for like the other things and the impact it makes on your life, like again, we were talking about like in one of the interviews like I did this morning, like with Steve Yeo, like again, to like I've talked to people who like don't even know who he is, but like to me, like that was like, you know, this guy did Zenith and like this stuff, and like, oh, he does like 20 AD, and like I was like, oh man, like I was so fucking excited, and like there's like other people like I don't even know who that is, and I was like, but like it's like a huge thing to me, and like I think that's the love of again, like comics, it's there's such an endearing aspect to comics, like it brings out, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a way to relate to the creators, right, for sure. And even though this is a little bit of a different tangent, that idea that comic books are, you know, dispensable, throwaway entertainment for kids or just superheroes, that is a very specifically North American viewpoint. It's bizarre. Marvel and DC kind of took over the comics market here in North America. So that's kind of what the you know, everyday Joe that you would approach would think of immediately when they think comics, whereas in Europe, France specifically is one of the big ones in Europe, and Japan, these places where comics are lauded as incredibly respectable art forms and thought of in the same way as, you know, movies or fine art or anything like that is concerned. But for some reason, still here in America, or North America, it's trapped in this, you know, 60s or 70s ice age where superheroes are the only comic books. And that's starting to change a little more now because the trade publishers, Random House and Penguin and those places, have been publishing graphic novels that are not genre related to those genres in any aspect. So I think there's a shift in the viewpoint of comics now, which is great, because you almost cringe when people ask what you do and you say, I'm a cartoonist and I make comics. And the first thing they ask you inevitably is, oh, you draw Spider-Man. And you just sort of, you know, shrink down to 2 feet and run away back under your rock. But that's starting to change, I think, which is great.
Yeah. Well, you can draw Spider-Monkey.
I did, close. Actually. That's true. That's a little bit of a you know, jab at that aspect of creating comics.
Yeah, and that's I always hate bringing it up because I feel like a show for it, and then to like on weekends I work at Barnes and Noble, yada yada. Like it's and the one of the so interesting things is that it's something we've talked about a bunch is like this the growing market for younger adults and kids like in comics, and the graphic novel medium is so crazy. Like that is the biggest thing, like in talking to kids, and like even my 7-year-old has been like reading there's a book called Sparks, and like the second one just came out like 2 weeks ago, and he was like, all he fucking will talk about it. I'm like, all right, I got it, like it's coming out, and he's like, shut up about it, and he read it in like a day, and like over the weekend he read it like 3 times, and like it's just like this like great thing to see, because again, like it's, and all of those are like topics that aren't I mean, there are obviously, like, our superhero ones, but they are, like, the type of stuff that will lead people into, like, you know, milk and cheese or...
Yeah.
Like, they're almost, like kid versions of, like, Daniel Klaus and, like, those, like, right. weird
type and, things. And, so. Yeah, I think there are the superheroes or heroes that are part of that emergence, but the topics and the genres and the different things that people are talking about inside of the graphic novel market is so varied, and that's wonderful to see. So I kind of mentioned in passing earlier that I was signed to a literary agent, and the book that we're starting to shop right now is a middle grade one, because that is just this demographic that is ablaze right now and just exponentially increasing all the time. And I think it's wonderful, and hopefully, you know, that, you know, it's going to sound terrible, but, you know, like cigarettes, you hook them young. I'm hoping that graphic novels are kind of following in the same footsteps right now. You know, you get them young and you show them that comics can open these vast worlds and really interesting characters and places and stories. And hopefully that follows them into adulthood, where they'll discover people like Daniel Klaus or, you know, any of those creators. So it's nice to see. And that, you know, far more so than the direct market, that is the, you know, graphic novels are just continuing to grow in sales.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Guts is far more appealing. Is it like Guts and Smile and all that, far more appealing than the, like, sixth volume of DC Death Metal or
right. you know, stuff. Kids or some trade paperback of 26 floppies, monthly floppies that you already own. It's just, it's kind of absurd. And they were sort of moving to that format anyway with the trade paperbacks. And I think more and more people have stopped buying the monthly floppies because they just wait for the collected editions. So the mindset should be, why don't we just do graphic novels? But yeah. You know, DC and Marvel aren't exactly owned by creative types anymore, but that's a different story.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I do now. I mean, I was someone spending $100 a week sometimes at the shop, and, like, space-wise, it was crazy. Reading-wise, like, again, it was crazy. And I was, like, buying stuff to buy it, and then as I was able to kind of cultivate that more, just switch to, like, hardcovers and trades, and obviously still read in the one benefit, because in comics media they don't pay you any, like, they don't mean no. they'll get paid for right. anything, even the site stuff we do, so, like,
yeah.
like, they pay you in free review copies, right. So, like, we read that, but yeah,
it's
like,
not exactly the money truck backing yeah. up to your garage.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'll trade PDFs on the street for my medicine. So yeah, it's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
For people, it's something I like to ask in, like, a lot of the written interviews I do, but I think it applies to kind of for anyone that might pick up Mr. Butterchips or maybe even has read it, like, what do you hope they take away from their experience with it?
Number one, again, it's about the humor for me. So I hope whoever reads it, I hope they find it funny. And I know some of it can be sort of deadpan or subtle sometimes, because that's just kind of my sense of humor. It's very sarcastic. That's the other part. And I think that can sort of fall under the deadpan sort of banner sometimes. So I hope people find it funny. And underneath that, maybe some people who don't think exactly like I do can at least question some of their values or question some of the things that they believe that may be hurting others and may be damaging towards society. And if that makes them think just a little bit, great. But I think the main thing for me is the humor. I'm trying to make people laugh, and especially during a period of our history that has been so very dark and depressing, you know, hopefully this can be a little bit of levity inside of that horror show.
Hopefully 2020 and a couple months won't require Mr. Butterchips to, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't think any of the topics that I'm handling are going away anytime soon. But hopefully we're in a better place to you know, be able to enjoy it and sort of take a step back from it, as opposed to being right in the midst of the shit right now like we are. Right. Knee deep.
If you've ever watched a super close-up time-lapse video of Cell Division while chipping the
balls. Oh, I did. I absolutely did, which is where that came from. And, you know, that has absolutely nothing to do with anything going on in society, but I still feel like it's a worthwhile PSA for people who may be considering doing that, because don't. That's my
suggestion. Yeah, it just seemed too specific not to have actually happened.
No, and that's the thing, too, is I think I am highly specific in a way where people can either relate and think, oh my god, I did something similar, or, yeah, he must have done at least something similar to that to have this kind of specificity, like watching a time-lapse of Cell Division. And I think it was, my wife is a microbiologist, and I think it was a video she may have even forwarded to me. And so I was a little bit in an altered state, we'll say, one night, and I decided to watch it, and whew, man, like reading or watching The Shining or something would have been a better idea. Because that is harrowing.
Before we ask you where people can find your stuff, I'll let Tim do his final question.
Sure.
Always relevant.
Always relevant. Okay, so Alex, gun to your head, if you were forced to write one episode of The Big Bang Theory, what would happen?
Is it an asshole thing to say if I would kill them all?
No, that would be the that's most... a quite popular answer.
No, I don't know if I'd kill them all. I think, honestly, I would make them... I would have an episode where it was called into question the whole, you know, nice guy veneer, because there's a lot that's going on there that is not appropriate and not okay. There is a lot of misogyny and kind of discrimination, and it's under the guise of nerds, so you're supposed to accept it for what it is because they're downtrodden or marginalized in some way. But that's absolute horseshit, and they need to be held accountable for a lot of what's been done and said on that show. So I think for me, I wouldn't kill them because that's letting them off too easy. I think I would have them, you know, have some sort of reckoning with the behavior that's happened. Maybe that's too long of an answer, but that's probably what I would do.
No, and that's... I wish I could remember it because I referenced it. I should look it up at some point.
Maybe one of them would die. Just to make the rest of them reflect on their lives.
Yeah, well, we could have, like, is it Penny, Tim? That's right, Penny? That sounds correct. Yeah, she could have some sort of retribution for the, like, season's worth of misogyny. There's some video, I wish I could, again, I've referenced it a couple times, I'll have to look it up, where, like, a guy goes and breaks down, it's like a 20 to 30 minute video, goes through and, like, breaks down that, essentially that, like, the hidden misogyny of that show, and where, like, it is essentially, like, building that, like, nice guy narrative, especially kind of what we see now with, like, the, you know, red pill, like, you know, women deserve me type of thing, and under the disguise of nice guy.
Yeah, I'm a nice guy. Why won't any of these fucking bitches realize that? And it's just this absurd mindset that, you know, people just say, oh, he's just a nerd or a dorkable or whatever they use. And it's absolute garbage. I mean, these people are terrible.
What? They like Batman, yeah. So that's cool. Yeah.
Well, and just real quick on the breakdown of the Big Bang Theory, like you were talking about that one gentleman or whoever did it. There's also one called Zach Morris's Trash, so if there are any Saved by the Bell fans out there,
yes,
that is a phenomenal piece. And it's in little bite-sized chunks. It's like 2 minutes long where the guy just goes through and drags Zach Morris for 2 minutes throughout the overview of each episode, which is fantastic. So Zach Morris's Trash, look that up too. If you haven't.
I'm going to have that jingle stuck in my head. Zach Morris's
Trash. Yep.
Yeah, I've watched that so much with my wife. Like, I love when, like, the new, like, quote-unquote season of it comes out. Especially because, like, again, she'll watch it. And she's just, like, I don't know what she was doing. I was making fun of her. Because, like, she has no cultural reference for anything, like, in her childhood. I have no fucking idea what she was doing growing up. I was just talking to her about, Tonya Harding and like Monica Lewinsky stuff, and like I was reading some articles about like maligned women in history and like, you know, how like, you know, the media has fucked over these people who didn't deserve it, and like he was like, "What did they do?" And I was like, "What? What the fuck are you talking? Where have you been?" But
that must have been a large book.
Yeah, and she was like, "We're watching the Zach Morris's trash," and she's like, "Oh, he was really that bad." I'm like, "Have you watched this show? He's like a psychopath."
It's pretty awful. So they need something, I think, similar to that for Big Bang Theory. Somebody just needs to drag those dumb shits through the mud. It would be delicious.
And I looked it up quick. It's the YouTube channel is Pop Culture Detective, and the series is called The Adorkable Misogyny of the Big Bang Theory.
There you go.
And I think he has another one called The Complexity of Geek Masculinity and the Big Bang Theory. But those both are really good. Why that show is terrible, but which is not a good segue into how can people find your work, and if they want to either see what you're doing or like again get any of your work, what is the easiest way to do that?
My main site is alexschumacherart.com, and my Twitter and Instagram, which are the two that I update most frequently, are both AJ Schumacher Art, at AJ Schumacher Art. So same handles for both sites.
And like I said, you have everything on there. And again, you could read a lot of the Mr. Butterchip stuff.
Oh, right. So that's on drunkmonkeys.us. That's the literary magazine site. So the majority
of... Don't tell them that. Then they got to go buy it.
Well, they'll still have to buy it to read the 22-page story, because that's not up anywhere. Or, you know, the gallery of illustrations that some of my friends did or anything like that. So hopefully those are the breadcrumbs that lead them to buying the book, which can be bought on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or IndieBound at your favorite local bookstore.
Yeah.
How's that for a plug?
That's good. And I will, if you're, again, it's, go buy, because it is, again, it's great, it's funny, it looks great, but again, just like for the experience of sitting down and reading it, like I read it in one sitting, like just the kind of, again, like the progression and timeline is so interesting. So I think people will be
excellent
missing it. And if like I think the 22 page long form at the end, like, is a great culmination of that. So if you have read the stuff on the site, I think that is like you are doing yourself a disservice by not finishing that out.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. But I'm going to let you say it, because if I say it, I sound like a, you know, self-aggrandizing asshole.
Well, speaking of self-aggrandizing asshole, Tim, where can we find you?
I write over at Comics Pit, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Tim Madera.
Tim, I don't think you're...
that makes one of us.
And then, we're on... if we remember to update the Twitter, it's at pages_panels. There's a Patreon. We're going to be having a September book club. I don't remember what the title of it was. Who won? The Demon Bear Saga?
Yeah, Demon Bear won.
Yeah, so we're going to be Demon Bear Saga arc, and then doing like a live stream book club.
Is that like Care Bears After Dark?
Oh, that would be interesting. It's the... Who is it?
The
New
Mutants.
Chris Claremont, Bill Sienkiewicz. I'm going to capitalize on that movie that might be coming out.
I feel like you keep trying to wrap up and I just waylay it more.
No, it's all good.
Yeah. I mean, you were talking about the feeling of being a professional. We have no professionality or anything to it.
To be clear, I wasn't referring to myself when I said that.
Oh. Nothing will be as ever
I'm
as
sure
awkward.
There are some people who feel like professionals out there. I don't know that I'm one of them.
Nothing will ever be as awkward as a guest asking us what our Instagram is and us saying, oh, we should probably set one of those up.
Yeah, you have a website, you have a Twitter, you're fine.
Yeah. It's just another thing that I would not remember to update, so it'd be good.
Right.
We, again, appreciate it so much for you taking the time.
That was my pleasure. Thank you.
Everyone, go pick this up. Excited, and Tim, I promise next time we will talk about George Lopez.
I've been dying to talk about it.
I was looking forward to talking about Carmen too, but oh well. Guess we'll just talk about Mr. Butter Chips.
Guess so. And then we should take a cue one of these time and just have the guest. We should just not even tell them and just have the guests. Like, what are your thoughts on that? But that would not go well. But that is this episode of Pages and Panels.
Bazinga! Bazinga! Hugging is a...